Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
This is David Corey along with my co-host Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. Hello, Richard.
Hello, David, and good evening to everybody. Tonight we are going to discuss an incredibly important topic that affects everyone, and that is the full impact and costs of war. Our regular listeners know that some of our prior guests have been combat veterans who describe the impact of war on their lives. One of our recent guests was the mother of a veteran who died by suicide after fighting war-related post-traumatic stress for years. Other guests have included people who work for organizations that help veterans and their families and who can attest to the short-term and long-term harm of war. Well, tonight we are going to examine the costs of war from a broader but still in-depth perspective. That includes not only the impact on individual soldiers, but also on entire nations. That is socially, financially, culturally, and politically. I do want to remind everyone that this is a call-in show that welcomes your views and guests and questions. So call us during the show at 1-888-627-6008. Again, the toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. Since we want our guests to have a chance to fully discuss their insights, we will hold off taking calls tonight until 30 minutes after the hour. Back to you, David.
Thank you, Richard. It is my privilege to introduce our two special guests this evening to discuss the cost of war, Professor Catherine Lutz, and we're waiting for her to arrive on the show, and Professor Nita Crawford. I'll introduce both now. Professor Catherine Lutz is a professor of anthropology and international studies at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University. She is also a co-director of the Cost of War Project at Brown University. She recently received a Guggenheim Foundation grant to write a book on how Americans across diverse communities understand war and its consequences. Professor Lutz is the author of numerous books on the U.S. military and its bases and personnel, including books such as Breaking Ranks, The Bases of Empire, and Homefront, A Military City in the American 20th Century. She is a co-founder of the Network of Concerned Anthropologists. She has also conducted research on U.N. peacekeeping in Haiti, South Sudan, Liberia, and Lebanon. Professor Lutz is past president of the American Ethnological Society, the largest organization of cultural anthropologists in the United States. She earned a Ph.D. degree from Harvard University in social anthropology and a B.A. degree in sociology and anthropology with distinction from Swarthmore College. Excuse me. Professor Nita Crawford of Boston University is the author of the landmark book, Accountability for Killing, Moral Responsibility for Collateral Damage in America's Post-9/11 Wars, published by Oxford University Press in 2013. Professor Crawford is also the author of two other books, Soviet Military Aircraft, published in 1987, and Argument and Change in World Politics, published in 2002. The latter book named a co-winner of the 2003 Best Book in International History and Politics by the American Political Science Association. She has written more than two dozen peer-reviewed articles on issues of war and peace. Professor Crawford has served on the governing board of the Academic Council of the United Nations System and on the governing council of the American Political Science Association. She is also a co-director of the Cost of War Project of Brown University. Professor Crawford earned a Ph.D. degree in political science from MIT and a Bachelor's of Arts from Brown University. While at Brown University, her independent concentration was the war system and alternatives to militarism. Prior to joining the faculty at Boston University, Professor Crawford was on the faculty at Brown University and the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for being on the Veterans News Hour.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you. And apparently Professor Lutz is not with us yet, but let's go ahead and proceed. Professor Crawford, can you tell us why the Costs of War Project was started? Who are its participants and what are its goals?
Well, we started tracking costs of war in 2010 with about 20 academics. And what we wanted to do then was to summarize not just the economic costs or the budgetary costs of war, but also the human costs of the war since 9/11. So recognizing that the 10-year anniversary would be upon us, we recruited these two dozen academics. We've now grown to about three dozen academics, including anthropologists, historians, economists, and attorneys, to understand the various, in their various areas of expertise, what were the costs of these conflicts for Americans, for our allies, and in for the people in the war zones.
I see. I understand Professor Lutz is now with us. Welcome this evening to the Veterans News
Thanks
Hour.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, and we were just beginning with an overview of the Cost of War Project and its participants and goals. I'll perhaps ask you, if you would, maybe to elaborate a bit on the specific goals of the project.
Yeah, well, as Dr. Crawford was saying, we were very concerned to make sure that the most up-to-date and in-depth kind of information was available to the American public as we approached that 10th anniversary, as she said. And the kinds of information that had been circulating in the press was pretty thin, and we knew that there was some expertise that we could pull together to try and give a richer sense of what the war had meant for veterans, what it meant for civilians in Afghanistan, what it meant for a policeman or a soldier on the ground in Iraq, and so on. So that was really our goal, to make it so that the conversation about war could be held on the grounds of information rather than just assumption or belief.
Right. Now we're going to...
Professor... Okay.
Go ahead, Richard.
This is Richard Hurley. Good evening, professors. There is so much we can talk about tonight, so let's just jump right into some of the details. Professor Crawford, can you help us understand the Iraq and Afghanistan wars' costs in human lives among all categories of persons affected, including the U.S., Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, as well as any other countries directly and indirectly affected by the wars?
Well, the first place I think we should start is the civilian toll. And I think that if you break it down by country, it might be confusing, but essentially the countries involved are Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, and Syria at this point. Remember that the U.S. only got involved in the Syrian war recently, starting in late 2014, but all told, 400,000 Syrian civilians or so have been killed. Now, in the wars that the United States instigated or entered following the 9/11 attacks, about 35,000 Afghan civilians have been killed. Many Pakistanis, about 23,000 Pakistani civilians have been killed, and Iraq is by far the worst affected zone, with about 200,000 civilians killed directly. Now, these are direct deaths that we can trace to bombs, bullets, fire, and so on. So all told, it's about 658,000 civilians in these war zones. Of course, the United States and its allies are not responsible for all those deaths, and the U.S. has also suffered casualties as well. Nearly 7,000 U.S. soldiers have been killed. Many more in Iraq, 4,400, but we're approaching a larger number in Afghanistan, 2,388,
wow,
as of today. And then the U.S. has fought with allies either the local military and police or countries such as the UK, Italy, and so on. And tens of thousands of those people have been killed. So, for instance, in Afghanistan, they can hardly keep people in the Afghan military and police because of the high casualty rates. There are 47,000 Afghan military and police have been killed in the war since 2001 that we know of. And this is a very political number, so they don't really want to talk about it too much. Then 12,000 at least, and there are no up-to-date numbers of Iraqi national military and police have been killed. And in Pakistan, many police have been killed. Now, in terms of militants, again, tens of thousands of militants have been killed, and this is a category that we don't know too much about. We have ballpark estimates. But I would say that in these war zones, approximately 100,000, all told, militants have been killed. Then other people are there as well, journalists, aid workers, and contractors. Of those groups, contractors have taken a hit as well, about the same number, 1,600 or so, in Afghanistan and Iraq, in each war zone, so more than 3,200 or 3,300 contractors. Now, that's a lot of numbers, but I think the main thing we want to keep in mind here is that by far the greatest harm in terms of deaths is civilians who are directly killed. And then we have another category of death for civilians, which is indirect death. The people who are dying because they don't have access to medical care. They don't have safe roads to get to medical care, or the hospitals have been destroyed or damaged, or medical workers have left, or there's no safe drinking water, and so on. This is a category of indirect harm, and we don't know how many of those people have been killed in these different war zones, but it's probably safe to say that between 2 and 4 times as many of people have died from direct injuries caused by the wars.
That's unbelievable. You know, the loss of human life is tragic. Professor Crawford, can you describe for us the war's costs in U.S. dollars, including the long-term financial legacy of the wars in the U.S., and then compare those to any original predictions by the Bush administration about those coups?
Right. Well, let's start with the predictions, which are, in hindsight, comical. They suggested that, for instance, that the Iraq war would be in the tens of billions of dollars. And in fact, the Bush administration believed that it might pay for itself. There were really no estimates and hearings about the Afghan war, and there really wasn't too much thought in either case about how long these wars might last, other than the initial optimistic assumptions that they would be short and sweet and we'd be greeted as liberators in Iraq and Afghanistan. So a lot of optimism about both the time that the U.S. would be in these wars and their economic toll. I'll just give you the bottom line first and then tell you what it's made of, composed of. Let's talk about the U.S. military budget. There are two things in the U.S. military budget. There's the base budget, which covers everything from, pay to health care and bases and buying bullets and replacing weapons that are chewed up in war. And then there's special war appropriations. And we call these war appropriations now the overseas contingency operations. And they happen in two places. As I said, in the Pentagon, it's a DOD account. And then there's the State Department also has special war appropriations, OCO money. In total, that's about $1.8 trillion, almost $1.9 trillion, actually. And then that's one bottom line, and that's the bottom line most people talk about, this OCO money. But there are other war-related costs that I want to be sure that we're clear about, because we know that the overall military budget has risen in the last 16 years. In fact, when the spending on the wars have gone down, sometimes the U.S. military budget stays, the base budget part, the non-war part, stays the same or goes up. So there isn't really a good correlation between military spending for the war and military spending just in general. So the base budget spending has essentially gone up, and it's institutionalized parts of the war. So we count part of that as related to the war, and that's about $800 billion. And then we also know that the veterans have come out of these conflicts, and now they need care. They've needed care since 2001 and 2002. And that's cost about, so far, $240 billion. And that will cost another $1 trillion over the next several decades as the veterans continue to leave, soldiers continue to leave the service and take up their compensation and use medical care. And then there's Homeland Security spending, which is directly related to missions that are associated with the war on terror. That's about $500 billion. And so when you add all of these things up and the spending that the U.S. Congress is considering right now for the next fiscal year, it's about $5.4 trillion that the U.S. has spent already, will spend for veterans care, or will spend in the next fiscal year.
That is just an amazing, mind-boggling statistic. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's very hard. It's a gigantic number, and it's very hard to wrap our minds around what that involves. But it's the equivalent of you know, whole swaths of the federal budget when you add it up over the time since 2001.
Right, and I think it would also be interesting to think of it in terms of what the $5.4 trillion could be used in terms of domestic spending and all sorts of needs in the country, and maybe we can talk more about that throughout the show. Professor Lutz, I'd like to ask you if you could tell us about the public health consequences of the war, including not just U.S. veterans living with war injuries and illnesses, although that's certainly important, but also the people of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, well, again, as Dr. Crawford was saying, each of the countries had a different situation, has had a different experience of war, and had a different health situation and wealth situation before the war as well. In the case of Iraq, it had one of the most advanced public health systems in the Middle East. People would come to Baghdad for health care from around the region, and the health stats for the people of Iraq were very high for the region. And Afghanistan had experienced years of war before the U.S. entered in 2001, and between that and a series of other historical conditions, that country had relatively poor health situation. But in both cases, in the case of Iraq more precipitously, the health of the population declined as a result of the war. Obviously, the level of death that Anita was just talking about is monumental, but there have also been many, many injuries. There are now hundreds of thousands of people who are living with war injuries, whether as civilians or as former police or soldiers in those countries. So we have the war death, the war injury, and then more generally, war is not good for a public health system. As you said, Iraq had a strong system. The initial bombing of the country and the ongoing violence resulted in the loss of numbers of doctors, the degradation of the hospital system, and at this point, even these many years after the worst violence is over across the country of Iraq, the The population is still having to go overseas to find medical care for some basic problems like cancers and repair of injuries and so on. So there's a real exodus as people go to Lebanon and other countries in the region to get their health care. The United States has devoted some resources to reconstructing Iraq and reconstructing Afghanistan, some of those dollars have gone into the healthcare system, but not enough to compensate for the damage or to make up for the progress that had been made and was now lost as a result of the war. There's also a tremendous amount of mental health consequences of the war, epidemic levels of depression and anxiety, as you could imagine, when your whole community, when you lose a loved one or your community is uprooted. And again, there are now millions of migrants, people who are refugees or internally displaced as a result of the war. And for those people, again, the mental health issues as well as the loss of access to those things which made for a healthy life it is a result of that dislocation from the violence. So it's not a good picture.
I see. And one of the things you had mentioned made me think of a lesson that we're still seeing from the Vietnam War, which is all the millions of unexploded bombs and mines that are continuing to kill and maim people in Vietnam. I suppose that's another tragic legacy that we'll see in these wars as well. Can you describe for us, Professor Lutz, how these wars have changed the social, the cultural, the political landscape of the United States as well as the countries where these wars have been waged?
Well, I think one of the things that war tends to do is to give support to more authoritarian forms of government and to allow for various forms of corruption. And we know that's it wasn't new to either country, to Iraq or Afghanistan, as a phenomenon, but the wars have certainly accelerated this, dropping Iraq and Afghanistan both down further and further on lists that are kept of levels of corruption, countries with higher or lower levels of corruption. So, again, one of the reasons that happens is because there are new resources that start to flow in directions that they hadn't traditionally, and some of that struggle over resources occurs in a way that, makes an authoritarian regime, it gives power to people who otherwise might not have it in a more democratic and less war-torn society. So the levels of economic dislocation, the levels of political and economic malfeasance, I think, are also something that we can identify in both cases. And in the United States, we know that one of the first questions that people started to ask in 2001 was, is our fear of being attacked again going to allow for an erosion of our democratic freedoms? Are we going to allow more surveillance? Are we going to allow the government to accrue more power to make the kinds of decisions that might otherwise be made in the light of day? So I think we can see that has happened to some important degree. The growth of offices within the government who are engaged in various kinds of surveillance, the emergence of different new categories by which the government has allowed for people to not be treated to the same levels of our legal system, and these the forms of secret detention and transmit that have been allowed and that have been have occurred as the United States pursues its counterterror policies. And some of these are new forms of secret and one can say undemocratic and even violations of human rights that are more common now than they were before 2001.
See, so there's quite a big impact when you look at things from all those different layers, things that aren't really discussed much in the ordinary media. Richard, I understand that you have a question for Professor Crawford.
Yes, here's Professor. Put on your past due hat here. And in hindsight, if we could go back in time to the start of the war in Afghanistan, and go back in time before the decision was made to invade Iraq in 2003. What would be the most compelling arguments that could be made to explain and support alternative decisions about going to war and how to wage war and also to support less costly and more effective ways to prevent further terror attacks? Another loaded question, Professor.
Okay. Well, I'm one of those people who was against the Iraq War well before it started. So I don't have to imagine the arguments. I made them unsuccessfully along with thousands of other people. For one, we didn't have very good evidence that Iraqis had weapons of mass destruction. We had a very weak press, unwilling to question assertions, and a Congress that was quiescent in 2002. But that was in the The climate then was very supportive of war. We'd already been at war and frankly thought we were winning. In 2001, there was a righteous feeling that, of course, we should respond, and it was self-defense. At that point, there were too few arguments about alternatives. And one of the alternatives was to simply try to work through international law and treat the terrorists as the criminals that they are. We still actually have that option, is to treat terrorism as a crime and not make war. And why is that so important? I think we can see now that the estimates in 2001 for Afghanistan were that there were 45,000 Taliban. And that was the estimate given President Bush. Now, in 2005, they thought they'd killed many of them, and they said that there were 2,000 to 10,000 of them left. But just last year, the CIA estimated that there were between 20 and 40,000 Taliban and other insurgents in Afghanistan. So we've hardly made any progress. Yet we've killed tens of thousands, and the U.S. and its allies killed tens of thousands of people. So clearly, you can't kill your way out of this. And the idea that you can, I think, is wishful thinking at best and dangerous at worst. It's actually counterproductive to kill in these places because too often civilians are harmed or killed. And as I've said, hundreds of thousands have been killed. And when that happens, people are radicalized and turn against the perceived perpetrators. In this case, the side with the biggest weapons, the U.S. and its allies. So my hindsight says sanctions, true self-defense, that is defending the homeland, which is what the Department of Homeland Security is meant to do, and treating terrorism as the crime that it is and not as an act of war.
I think that's a really important point that I think the media doesn't really touch on, which is what are the alternative decisions? Because when we talk about the cost of war, I think many people understand at some level that war is just a horrible way to solve human problems. But then looking at alternative ways that are less costly, not just financially, but in terms of human lives and suffering and all these other consequences that we've been talking about, is really the key. It's really the next part of the discussion, which I think needs to happen. So I'd welcome both our professors to elaborate, perhaps more on that, if you will, before I want to give each of you an opportunity to talk about your books. But any further thoughts about that part of the discussion, which perhaps needs to happen nationally? Are our leaders not asking the right questions, for example?
Yeah, well, I think one of the kind of shorthand ways that I think of this, whenever there's a call to war, and we have the example right now of North Korea, where it, I think one of the things that the American public's been led to believe is, and maybe less so the veteran population than the civilian population, but led to believe that war is a simple thing, right? That it is, that force works straightforwardly and easily to accomplish the goals that we set for it, when in fact we're often trying to accomplish something that's much more complicated and much more not amenable to to force, right? Force does certain things, but not many other things. And so I think the thing to ask about this is the, you know, again, what's when the call to war goes out, what is force going to accomplish, and what will be its unintended consequences, which of which there are always many, many. Again, anticipating the millions of refugees, anticipating the long-term 50, 60 years of disability in large populations, both civilian and veteran, those kinds of unintended consequences that are social and political that we talked about. And then finally, that question of financial costs, right? The idea that the governments have often underestimated what wars will cost, as Dr. Crawford just pointed out. And if we ask those three questions, it will often lead to look for alternative solutions like policing or the kinds of other things that Anita just mentioned.
Could I add to that? I think that
please, yes.
We have a Congress right now that has the opportunity to ask hard questions. What are the criteria for progress? How will we know? What benchmarks will we use for progress? And progress can't be killing people. Progress has to be thinking about leaving these places better than when we entered. And then how do we know that Americans are safe? There's been no international terrorist attack. Why is that in the United States? We've had plenty of domestic terrorism and gun violence, but there has been no 9/11-style attack since 2001. Is it that homeland security measures are effective? In which case, let us stop spending so much abroad and concentrate at home. So Congress should be asking much harder questions about this, and they should ask questions about how long do we think we can keep this up? Because it has really harmed us in terms of the ways that weren't anticipated, many ways, greater indebtedness at the federal level, fewer resources for other activities of government, as you mentioned, including infrastructure, and also military spending is so much less economically productive. It produces fewer jobs than spending in these other sectors. I think that we have had this sort of weight on our back called military spending, and it's prevented the economy more than anything else I can think of from being better than it is. And the economy isn't horrible, but it could be much better. And so I think we need to ask our Congress people to really work much harder at getting any administration to spell out how they think this is going to work, how we know it's going that it is working, and then how are we going to get out? How can we end these wars?
I see, I appreciate your insights. And before we get to our discussion of each of your books, I don't want to miss this opportunity to ask a follow-up question about North Korea. You know, the last couple weeks, PBS has been broadcasting the Ken Burns Vietnam series, and it's, you know, that's 50 years after the war. People are still studying the lesson. Now there's an opportunity for there to be some serious discussions before we would stumble into a war with North Korea. Should there be, and what kind of discussion or analysis could be made to start educating decision makers to say, if we go to war with North Korea, these are going to be the immediate and long-term consequences on all the different layers of harm that we've talked about this evening. And I know I'm just throwing this question out there for general discussion. Any thoughts?
Well, first of all, it's an incredibly risky endeavor to deal in threats of nuclear annihilation, total destruction. And as we see, it doesn't work, but it doesn't cause people to back down. Threats generally don't cause people in schoolyards or in the world to back down. They, like Saddam Hussein, they sort of, you know, harden up. And they say, well, you can't come. So I don't think the threats are working. And the risks are, you know, could the United States invade North Korea on the ground? Yes. Would it look very much like the Korean War? No, much worse. Much, much worse. These are much more densely populated areas. We bombed every city in North Korea between 1950 and 1953. The Air Force said they didn't have any more targets. Millions of people died or were starving. And any war, yes, we could invade. It would be a much worse consequence for civilians, and tens of thousands of U.S. lives would be lost. If we escalate to nuclear war, you know, all bets are off. Would China join? Would the Soviets join? I doubt it. We'd hope that there'd be some restraint. But remember, the Soviet Union and later the Russians had something called the dead hand. They had something where if nuclear war began, they would automatically launch their nuclear weapons in case their civilian leadership were killed in what was called a decapitating strike. So we enter a realm of a very dangerous world, and I think the alternatives are simply negotiations, continued sanctions, the wiser course that somebody in the White House seems to be steering our head of state to. And these things can constrain the capacity of the North Koreans to make weapons and develop a large arsenal and decrease their capacity to get over the significant technical hurdles that they face. For instance, they don't have a missile that can survive reentry. It would burn up. That's a tremendous tragedy, but it's not going to make it to the U.S., right? It would burn up, and the nuclear material would be spread over a large area, several thousand miles. So if we continue to sanction them, we continue to diminish their technical capacity, and I think that's worthwhile. I don't think we need to say that they can't have nuclear weapons. I think we need to have negotiations. We have to have a place where they get something, we get something. Right now, this sort of stalemate, mano a mano, is not productive, in my view.
Yeah, one of the things I think that's so important is to have an accurate history of past wars, current wars, and to use that accurate history as a way of thinking about the present. So, for example, many people have a particular story that they've been told about the Cuban Missile Crisis, in which John F. Kennedy stood down Sergei Khrushchev and had him back up and withdraw his missiles from Cuba. But in fact, he engaged in diplomacy, and he understood the world from the perspective of the Soviets as well, through conversation, through diplomatic conversation, and knew that the U.S. missiles in Turkey were felt as threatening to the Soviets as their missiles in Cuba felt to us. And Kennedy would remove those missiles from Turkey. And I think something similar has to happen in the Korean case as well, and some more creative thinking about what it is that the United States can do to lessen the sense of threat that the North Korean regime feels at this moment as well. Not just from the bluster, but from the very aggressive military exercises up and down the peninsula that go on every year, from U.S. building up its basing system on Guam and building new bases on Okinawa. And so I think there are definitely things that can be done to lessen the tensions. It's certainly not a hopeless situation with fresh thinking.
I see.
David, if I may.
Go ahead, Richard.
I'll throw this out to both professors. Based upon, you know, your research and experience and your knowledge of history, considering the current environment in the White House, I mean, are you optimistic toward this kind of working itself out? Or you know, I hear this all the time from people. People are scared about what might happen and who's sitting in the White House right now. What's your opinion?
Well,
Professor,
I'll go out on a limb here. Go out on a limb and say I don't think he's the right person to be running a country, much less this country, because he operates, he shoots from the hip. He's very poorly informed about world affairs. And so this sort of the way he operates when he sells real estate and kind of bullies other players on the economic field in New York real estate, he thinks that's going to work in the much more complex and dangerous world of international affairs.
I see. Well, right. certainly grounds for hours of discussion on these topics, and I'm sorry we don't have enough time in tonight's show, but I want to ask each of the professors, if you would. I know you both have written a number of books. Professor Lutz, if we would start with you, you've written books including Breaking Ranks about Iraq War veterans, also the book Bases of Empire and Homefront, a Military City in the American 20th Century. Again, I wish we had hours to discuss these, but could you briefly give our listeners an overview of those books and the insights and key lessons that you would offer to members of the public as well as those in government who make decisions about the military and going to war?
Yeah, well, I think each of those books, particularly the book Homefront, which is about the city of Fayetteville and the relationship between the city and Fort Bragg, the books are about the infrastructure of war that we have developed over the decades, particularly since World War II in the United States, and the sort of taken for granted and somewhat invisible, particularly to people outside the military, the somewhat invisible you know, huge numbers and of bases of personnel deployed around the world, again outside of war zones, and the way in which that is not only represents a very expensive investment in security, but in fact, in some ways, operates at cross purposes to a broader view of what makes the community secure. So Fayetteville itself is a poor city. And I think in part we can attribute that, as we can in many American communities, to a failure to invest as heavily in our educational system, our healthcare system, and so on, as we do in our military system. So it looks more closely at what it looks like at ground level in the United States itself, when we see, you know, these investments and ask ourselves, you know, how does that reshape our country? How does it, from the very top, you know, the sort of concentration of power that in the executive branch, for example, that has occurred since, as a result, many historians and other analysts argue, as a result of that rise of a strong military and a dominance of the discretionary budget of the United States by military spending. I think, you know, the larger question of how did this come to be? How did we end up being a nation that's constantly prepared to go to war and having the kinds of military expenditures that rival, you know, the next several dozen countries combined, you know, how did that happen? Who's steering that ship? And I think, you know, and again, the idea that this is not cost-free, and that the efficacy of the having those instruments at war ever at the ready and everywhere around the world, I think hasn't been asked.
Well, thank you very much. I know I wish we had more time, and perhaps if you're interested, you can return to our show again and discuss these books in more detail, because I know they reflect a great deal of research and thought and analysis. Richard, over to you.
Yeah, thank you. Professor Crawford, I'd like to ask you the same question. Can you tell us about some of the books and articles you have written and the insights and lessons you offer for the public as well as policymakers, especially from your 2013 book, Accountability for Killing?
Well, let's just focus on Accountability for Killing, which was a book where I asked the question, how can we understand the moral and causal responsibility for collateral damage in Iraq and Afghanistan? And collateral damage was that term that we used to describe inadvertent killing of civilians. And it's kind of anodyne, but what I wanted to do was ask this question, who was morally responsible? Who was causally responsible? Was it the soldier at the pointy end of the stick or the person who drops the bomb? Or is it sort of the organization, the military organization that sends them out there and creates the conditions that they're operating in? And what I found was that in many ways the individual's moral agency was constrained. They're sent to a place like Iraq or Afghanistan or any number of other places, and they have few choices. They don't choose the weapons that they have. They don't choose the place that they go, and they don't choose the targets for the most part. In effect, all the decisions that we blame on an individual pilot and so on for accidents are their range of choices constrained much further back in the causal chain at the level of the general or the Pentagon and rules of engagement. And so what I was trying to do then was rethink the moral responsibility and help essentially give us some empathy for soldiers. And then I'm also now working on revising the cost of war estimates for both civilians and for the economic costs. And I think that's the most important work I do, really, is to help people, as Professor Lutz says, understand what it is that we do, how all these optimistic assumptions can lead to unanticipated consequences, which if we did know history, we would anticipate and perhaps avoid. So those are a couple of the things that I care deeply about. And then finally, I'm writing a book right now on the history of the U.S. treatment of civilians in war from the colonial era to the present. In other words, looking at how civilians have been targeted deliberately for either hearts and minds or for coercion by the U.S. military, and then how more recently the U.S. military has realized it doesn't work to target civilians because they resist, and they've begun, in fact, to be much more careful of civilian life. So in a way, it's kind of a good news story, but 350 years of bad news before that.
Wow. Well, I know we're rapidly drawing to a close. It's been a great discussion. I'd like, before we wrap up, though, I'd ask Professor Lutz, could you tell us how listeners can find out more about the Cost of War Project and how listeners can actually support its work?
Okay, yeah, we are at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University, and we have a website there which you can navigate to at costsofwar.org, one word, plural, costsofwar.org. And I think one of the things that is the most important thing that people can do to support what we're doing is by helping us circulate the website and circulate the information so that, some of these facts and alternative ways of thinking about security can replace the kinds of myths, I think, that we operate with more commonly in this country. And I think, you know, paying attention to the kind of upcoming these debates about North Korea and asking themselves and friends and neighbors these alternative questions. You know, what is there? Isn't there another way?
Right. I see. Well, thank you. It's been an awesome evening, and we'd like to thank both of you, Professor Catherine Lutz and Professor Nita Crawford, for sharing your knowledge and your insights with us tonight on the Veterans News Hour. And we wish you both continued success in all of your work. Thank you very much.
Thank you very
much. Thanks for having me.
And come back and join us again, please.
Be happy to. Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you. Over to you, Richard.
Well, David, this was an excellent discussion, and I hope we can get Professor Lutz and Professor Crawford back on our show. Hopefully our listeners will consider this as a starting point for more discussions with their families and friends and neighbors and government leaders. You know, David, I'm reminded of the famous 60s counterculture protest song by Norman Whitfield and Barrett Strong called War. What is it good for? And the refrain, as everyone may recall, in that song was two simple words, absolutely nothing. Back to you, David.
Thank you, Richard. And speaking of famous songs, before we end our show tonight with another famous song dating back to the days of the Vietnam War, we'd again like to thank Professor Catherine Lutz and Professor Nita Crawford of the Cost of War Project for sharing their knowledge with us tonight. We'd also thank our producer at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. And we will now bring our show tonight to a close with a song that somehow seems appropriate given the weighty issues of war and peace that we've tried to tackle tonight, and the goal of those among us who strive to be peacemakers. So with that, it's Peace Train, an idealistic song first became famous in 1971, written and performed by Cat Stevens. So let's take a listen.
Now I've been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world at one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.